Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight, we have a discussion presented by the Boston University Howard Gotlieb Archival Research Center titled Walt Whitman, the Year of His Birth, 1819. Our speakers, William M. and Sarah B. Warren, Professor of the Humanities, Christopher Ricks. Moderating tonight's discussion is Boston University Professor of English, Anita Patterson. We begin with a greeting by Gotlieb Center Associate Director Sean Knoll.
For many years, Professor Ricks has joined us really as the centerpiece for these gatherings, conversations. He's spoken on an extraordinary breadth of subjects, Bob Dylan, of course, films and radio plays of Samuel Beckett, Frost, Eliot, poetry, plagiarism, one of my favorites, actually. And it's one of my favorite parts of working here at the Gotlieb Center, being able to be part of organizing these events so that people can come and enjoy them. And tonight we have Professor Anita Patterson. We're very excited. Thank you from the Department of English, who I also was lucky enough to study with a little bit here as an undergraduate. And they're going to talk about Walt Whitman from 2019, 200 years from the year of his birth. So thank you for your indulgence. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'd like to let's start this conversation with Professor Ricks and Professor Patterson. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So Christopher and I decided that I would speak next. And first, I just want to thank you for inviting me. I'm so delighted to be here. And thank you, Sean, for everything you're organizing. I'm going to read some passages, but I'd like to give a little bit of context to them. I'm interested in Whitman's representation of African Americans. 1855 was a very kind of important year in terms of thinking about the crisis over slavery. And indeed, we can see Whitman's coming of age as a poet as being closely associated with his concerns about slavery as a threat to national unity in the U.S. He wrote a lot of journalism in the 1840s about slavery. And interestingly, in the journalism, we don't see nearly the same kind of identification and sympathy for the suffering of slaves. In fact, in a 1942 article titled Black and White Slaves, he actually argued that the condition of white workers in England was worse than slaves in the South. He was primarily concerned in his journalism in the years leading up to Leaves of Grass with political extremism. He was very concerned that the abolitionists and the South were both taking very extreme positions. He wrote in the Brooklyn Eagle an article titled "The Union versus Fanaticism." So I think that the kind of it's striking and interesting that by 1855, when he came out with Leaves of Grass, that we have this very profound and searching identification with African Americans on the part of the poet speaker. What I'd like to do is look at how Whitman actually turned to poetry as a way of mediating and healing social conflict. We can see this in the notebook passage. It's from a notebook. You can look at this online. A lot of his notebooks are online. This is called the Talbot Wilson Notebook, having to do, I think, with where he was living. The date is a little bit controversial. It used to be thought of as 1847, but now we see it as it could be a little bit more recent than that. But what's important about it, what critics have said about it, is that we see Whitman moving into the verbal manner of Leaves of Grass in when he's addressing the question of social division and the role of poetry in healing social division. I'll just read this passage for you. He writes... Oh, and it's also on the cover of the notebook, someone wrote, the earliest and most important notebook of Walt Whitman. I am the poet of slaves and of the masters of slaves. I am the poet of the body and I am the poet of the soul. I go with the slaves of the earth equally with the masters, and I will stand between the masters and the slaves, entering into both, so that both shall understand me alike. And the fact that he's starting to use these line breaks, they're not completely the same as the kind of lineation that he uses in Leaves of Grass. He uses what we call enjambment here. But there, it's the passage is centrally concerned with the poet and with poetry as affirming the equality of masters and slaves and the role of poetry as a mediator of conflict. So I think it's, you know, it's very interesting to look at this notebook. So the passage I'd like to read that has to do with his representation of slaves and his what we call cross-racial identification shows how he's struggling to free himself and his readers from racist assumptions and affirming the humanity and dignity of African Americans. This is the first passage, section 33, let's see, on the first page on the bottom right. The disdain and calmness of martyrs, the mother of old, condemned for a witch, burnt with dry wood, her children gazing on, the hounded slave that flags in the race, leans by the fence, blowing, covered with sweat, the twinges that sting like needles, his legs and neck, the murderous buckshot and the bullets, all these I feel or am. I am the hounded slave. I wince at the bite of the dogs. Hell and despair are upon me. Crack and again crack the marksmen. I clutch the rails of the fence. My gore drips, thinned with the ooze of my skin. I fall on the weeds and stones. The riders spur their unwilling horses, draw close, taunt my dizzy ears, and beat me violently over the head with whipstocks. Agonies are one of my changes of garments. I do not ask the wounded person how he feels. I myself become the wounded person. My hurts turn livid upon me as I lean on a cane and observe. So we see here that Whitman is focusing on the agony of the slave, placing him in the company of martyrs to dignify his suffering. And also placing him in the context of U.S. history, if we think of the Salem witch trials of the 1690s. So we have the kind of the subjection of women also figures in his representations. Here, whereas in the notebook passage we see the poet speaker identifying with both master and slave, we see in the concluding line of the passage a different kind of double consciousness, where we have the hurts, the wounded, the suffering of the hurt poet, observing and being livid, being angry at the poet who observes and leans on a cane. So we have a kind of double consciousness, which is analogous to the double consciousness of his identification with master and slave. And I think it's passages like these. I mean, you have to sort of place yourself in the context of 1855. It was very bold and progressive. And it's one of the reasons that Whitman's poetry was beloved by Sojourner Truth and later by Langston Hughes and June Jordan and a lot of African-American poets, I think, whose papers are here in this room. The next passage I'll read is from I Sing the Body Electric. This is on the second page. And this reflects Whitman's travels to New Orleans in 1846. He went to work as editor for the Crescent and spent 3 months there. A man's body at auction. For before the war, I often go to the slave mart and watch the sale. I help the auctioneer. The sloven does not half know his business. Gentlemen look on this wonder. Whatever the bids of the bidders, they cannot be high enough for it. For it, the globe lay preparing quintillions of years without one animal or plant. For it, the revolving cycles truly and steadily rolled. In this head, the all-baffling brain, in it and below it, the makings of heroes. Examine these limbs, red, black, or white. They are cunning in tendon and nerve. They shall be stripped that you may see them. Exquisite senses, life-lit eyes, pluck, volition, flakes of breathed muscle, pliant backbone and neck, flesh not flabby, good-sized arms and legs, and wonders within there yet. Within there runs blood, the same old blood, the same red-running blood. There swells and jets a heart. They are all passions, desires, reachings, aspirations. Do you think they are not there because they are not expressed in parlors and lecture rooms? This is not only one man, the father of those who shall be fathers in their turns. In him, the start of populous states and rich republics. Of him, countless immortal lives with countless embodiments and enjoyments. How do you know who shall come from the offspring of his offspring through the centuries? Who might you find you have come from yourself if you could trace back through the centuries? So I mentioned that Whitman witnessed slave auctions firsthand in New Orleans, and he kept a poster of the slave auctions in his room for many years afterwards to remind him of this experience that he witnessed firsthand. And so we see in this passage a kind of elaboration of this notion of the auctioneer, where he actually shows the sort of the pricelessness of human life and the wonder of the slave as a representative of all humanity. And I think it's profound and interesting how the physical presence of the slave is so vividly communicated, and that he's dignified as a progenitor in this passage. The poet speaker is identifying with the slave. There are passages elsewhere in Leaves of Grass where we talk about lecture rooms and parlors as an unfit place for a poet. So there's even a kind of identification there. And profoundly, I think Whitman talks about the sort of the hybridity of American culture, the fact that, you know, even today a lot of people who do Ancestry.com find that they have, they descend, they're of mixed descent and are in part African American. There's just a reference to the Civil War in the second line that was added to kind of suggest and envision the culmination of the crisis over slavery. So the last passages I wanted to read are on a kind of different, from a different perspective, but they're about Whitman's educational philosophy. During the late 1830s and 40s, Whitman was actually a school teacher in Queens, and he used very progressive experimental teaching methods that were being introduced into American education at that time by education reformers like Horace Mann. And I actually am a product of this progressive school education. And in fact, I went to school down the street from the school Horace Mann. So I feel the kind of approach that he took to learning is one that I find a great affinity for. And there's a lot of commentary on learning in his poems. He also wrote a lot of articles on education. People don't know this. But in an 1846 article published in the Brooklyn Eagle, he said, "We consider it a great thing in education that the learner be taught to rely on himself." And, you know, I've done a lot of work on Emerson in addition to Whitman, so I love this notion of self-reliance in learning. So here's a passage from Song of Myself that I think reflects this philosophy. It's the first one taken from section 2. "Have you reckoned 1,000 acres much? Have you reckoned the earth much? Have you practiced so long to learn to read? Have you felt so proud to get at the meaning of poems? Stop this day and night with me, and you shall possess the origin of all poems. You shall possess the good of the earth and sun. There are millions of suns left. You shall no longer take things at second or third hand, nor look through the eyes of the dead, nor feed on the specters in books. You shall not look through my eyes either, nor take things from me. You shall listen to all sides and filter them from yourself." There's another passage that also reflects Whitman's thinking about education. I was going to talk a little bit about the word reckon that he uses there, which is actually, it sounds like it's a word that's sort of associated with a regional southern dialect, but it's in fact a very old word that you find in medieval English texts. And the notion of reckoning as a kind of practice that makes perfect, he's trying to kind of equate that with reading. And it's something that would reach a lot of his readers who were not, you know, who were kind of rural people as well. He wanted to reach working people as well as other people. Okay, so the next passage from is from Song of Myself, and this is section 6. It's right underneath the passage, the other passage. A child said, "What is the grass?" Fetching it to me with full hands. How could I answer the child? I do not know what it is any more than he. I guess it must be the flag of my disposition, out of hopeful green stuff woven. Or I guess it is the handkerchief of the Lord, a scented gift and remembrancer, designedly dropped, bearing the owner's name some way in the corners, that we may see and remark and say, whose? Or I guess the grass is itself a child, the produced babe of the vegetation. Or I guess it is a uniform hieroglyphic, and it means sprouting alike in broad zones and narrow zones, growing among black folks as among white. Canuck, Tuckahoe, Congressman Cuff, I give them the same, I receive them the same. And now it seems to me the beautiful uncut hair of graves. So we see here a kind of reference to the grass as a kind of symbol that contains a multitude of meanings that we can only guess at. And the symbol accumulates meaning each time that it's used in Whitman's poetry. The poem tells us that we should approach this symbol with childlike wonder and actively and creatively engage his poetry in the same way that we learn to engage the world around us with a kind of childlike wonder. Read in this way, I think the grass communicates wisdom. Here he suggests that it communicates the wisdom of the kind of equality of all people. A Canuck is a French Canadian. A Tuckahoe is a Tidewater Virginian who eats Virginia truffles. And a Cuff is a reference to an African American. So we see this interest in bringing all these people in together equally. Finally, I love this passage because I think there's evidence that that Whitman was thinking about Wordsworth in this passage. In an 1846 article in the Brooklyn Daily Eagle called "Child at the Tomb," he quotes from Wordsworth's poem "Now We Are Seven," and discusses it at length. And there's a beautiful kind of reflection on just a grassy graveyard setting and a child's perception in that poem as well. So it's a kind of It's a lovely moment where you see Whitman recollecting Wordsworth as well. So I think I'll stop there.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Let me immediately ask people in the room for any comments before I pick up one or two things. Mm-hmm. Please.
And, I was wondering, when he says, "All these I feel or am,"
mm-hmm.
Which one is he feeling and which one is he... I was amming, but in the sense, like, why does he have to distinguish the two?
Well, I think one of the things that you see, and I mean, it actually relates to a lot of the poems where he talks about childlike perception, but I think that he really wants to connect sensation of the body as a kind of phase in this process of identification. I think the body is very important to Whitman. He doesn't want us to say that it's just sympathy in a sort of abstract way. And so feeling in terms of, you know, the actual physical experience of feeling is very an important step to being, to identification. So I think that's why he makes that distinction. But that's a really great question. It's interesting because you see it throughout.
Something of it would, for me, have to do with the way in which when he touches us, it's repeatedly through thinking about touching. And when he moves us, it's repeatedly through thinking about moving. Now, that wouldn't always have to be the case. That is the corporeal, the very corporeal nature of it. On the other hand, and this would be the thing that you and I, had we but world enough and time, we could talk about for a long time, I have real problems with identify with. Now, it's very important to your sense of it, and in fact, you've used it three or four times. I think a bad thing happened when Shelley brought into the English language the idea that if you care about somebody's suffering, it's because you identify them with you, and therefore there isn't any difference really between self-pitying and pitying other people. So I think that for me, one big question all the time with Whitman is how he holds off by some kind of antisepsis, some kind of prophylaxis, he manages to hold off the dangers of identifying with. That is, Princess Diana, everybody identified with her because they too were married to somebody with big ears who talked to plants and who expected to be on the throne of England and so on. Otherwise, they wouldn't have cared about her. That is, this huge rush of feeling, which is that you're really feeling sorry for yourself and they're just like you. So the Sylvia Plath case, you know, Jews suffer a great deal, I have suffered a great deal, therefore I'm an honorary Jew. It doesn't actually make for good writing in her, though there is lots of good writing in her. But yeah. So I'm just wondering whether, how you think, if you do as I do, that very extraordinarily he actually resists to identify with. Yeah. Although he says, I myself become the wounded person, as you pointed out, he moves on immediately to leaning on a cane and observing. Right. So you're not... Right. So you've conceded that that's not simply to be credited.
Yeah.
Works of literature want to be credited, but they don't want simply to be believed.
Right, and also that the phrase, my hurts turn livid upon me as I lean on a cane and observe, is fascinating because basically leaning on a cane and observing is essential because poetry is not just suffering. He's articulating the kind of the meaning of the suffering through his poetry. So he's not just kind of suffering by itself. He wouldn't be able to write if it were pure identification in that sense.
Well, an observe is having something to say as well as having seen something. When Eliot gives you Prufrock and other observations, he means things I've seen and things that I have to say about the things that I've seen, which will, of course, make me see it differently. Yeah. As a result of saying something about it, you then see it differently.
Yeah.
Does that issue in anybody else wanting to take up any of this particular concept of the identifying with, because I think it is, I am the man, I suffered, I was there. We have to say, no, you didn't. We have to distinguish Whitman from President Clinton. Clinton says, I feel your pain. No, he didn't. That is, the Onion quite rightly had this great headline, President feels nation's pain, comma, breasts. that's the sort of comic way of saying somebody, they feel pain, but they don't feel your pain, and it's imperious of them. And so, anyway, are we at one on that?
Yes. I mean, I think also you can see it in the notebook passage where he says, I am the poet of slaves and of the masters of slaves.
Yeah.
I mean, that this really complicates what his poetry is doing in terms of thinking about mediating conflict and having, you know, so it's, I mean, in that sense, it's not identification.
Well, and it's very strange that today in the paper we read about that newspaper which says the KKK should write again. Read that in the Globe today? I mean, absolutely astonished. The concurrence of that violence and horror with the great sanity which is in this and which you respond to. It's one very sane way of apprehending these things.
Yeah.
It isn't threatened by madness.
Yeah. So.
The poem, perhaps let me go to the poem that I care about most of these choices, and it's section 11 of Song of Myself. It's on this first page here. And I'll say something just about... let me read it and then say something about why I think it's extraordinary even for this extraordinary man and poet. 28 young men bathe by the shore. 28 young men, and all so friendly. 28 years of womanly life, and all so lonesome. She owns the fine house by the rise of the bank. She hides, handsome and richly dressed, after the blinds of the window. Which of the young men does she like the best? Ah, the homeliest of them is beautiful to her. Where are you off to, lady? For I see you. You splash in the water there, yet stay stock still in your room. Dancing and laughing along the beach came the 29th bather. The rest did not see her, but she saw them and loved them. The beards of the young men glistened with wet. It ran from their long hair. Little streams passed all over their bodies. An unseen hand also passed over their bodies. It descended tremblingly from their temples and ribs. The young men float on their backs, their white bellies bulged to the sun. They do not ask who seizes faster them. They do not know who puffs and declines with pendant and bending arch. They do not think whom they souse with spray. Now, I think it's astonishing, even in his work. I mean, it would be foolish to think that somebody who is homosexual with the energy and thoroughgoingness that Whitman possesses, it would be mean-minded to think he'd be sure to be mean-minded about women. Mm-hmm. That's stupid, though it's a stupidity which is out there, mm-hmm. and which is sometimes encouraged by a certain sort of camp manner. Yeah. But the generosity of this, it seems to be, it has this wonderfully difficult subject. It's mm-hmm. about voyeurism and so on. It's about the honourable forms that voyeurism can take. It's about the pathos that attends upon looking and imagining. It's the poem, I think, in which he most imagines somebody imagining, which is a real feat for him, because usually he's got so much imagining of his own going on, he doesn't need to imagine anybody else doing it. It seems to be a poem of the greatest delicacy. If somebody were to say it's soft porn, they would sort of be right, because the unseen hand is as much Whitman's as anybody else. It seems to, fit very mm-hmm. beautifully with things that you were saying. Yeah. But to breathe a completely different world, I mean, really quite astonishing. And it's as if all the things that on occasions take him over and insist on his doing as they say are just all in abeyance here. It knows about envy and it isn't envious. It knows how easy it is to patronize or to matronize a woman who doesn't have a man. Do you know what I mean? It knows how easy it is to somehow be against people because they're handsome or own handsome properties. Yeah. I mean, it's politically very intelligent and not at all censorious. I think it's quite lovely. What do you think?
Yeah, I love this passage. And in fact, I love the fact that he talks about loneliness in connection with the woman's experience. And in fact, I also, there's this short quote I'll read from the North American Review. He wrote this very late in his life. He said, "The current prurient conventional treatment of sex is the main formidable obstacle to the movement for the eligibility and entrance of women amid new spheres of business, politics, and the suffrage." I mean, he knew how important it was for him to get away from this prurient attitude toward sex. And, I mean, it's just incredible if you think how early he was doing this, I mean, and how he suffered. I mean, the reviews of the Leaves of Grass were just, I mean, people were horrified. And the British edition was, all the editions were expurgated. I mean, it was like, Joyce's Ulysses. Yeah.
But the tiny little coinciding, you see, I hadn't known the quotation. Current is very beautiful because of what water is and because of what the body electric is. So that he's got the extraordinarily cooperative subconscious. He doesn't have to plan or deliberate these things, but current turns up. Current then has this off rhyme with prurient. Mm-hmm. Prurient, of course, means itching. It's a very, very physical and corporeal word. Those of us who have every now and then to put some cream on, especially once the central heating. Do you know what I mean? That is that curious itch which is in the air. Yeah. The belief that the terrible thing about it is the wrong kind of itchiness and so on, with no honourable scratch. Do you know what I mean? It's the opposite of an unseen hand passing over.
Yeah.
I don't know, if I make a point and ask you where you stand about it, it would have to do with this not being at the mercy of his own notions. That is, the English poet critic William Empson was talking actually about Copernicus. Somebody had said Copernicus got this wrong. William Empson, who was trained as a scientist before becoming a poet and critic, Empson said, no, Copernicus was more intelligent than this person realizes, less at the mercy of his own notions. Now, it's very positive. It supposes that geniuses have lots of notions, and the only danger is of their being at the mercy of their notions. Now, for me, there are certain notions that Whitman has, and it's a pity that he's at the mercy of them. The belief that lines need to be very, very long is sometimes just a notion that he's got that he could have done well to resist. But what do you see in him a resistance to his own propensities, or do you think that he's encouraged by Emerson and other people to give self sort of unbridled power? What we all know is that self-expression is what matters and so on. Now, for centuries, people didn't know that. And they said, I wouldn't express that self if I were you. Mm. It's an extremely disagreeable self. The sooner you don't express it and the sooner you change it, the better. The idea that your duty is. But do you have a view on that in him?
Yeah, I think that the sort of the stereotype of Whitman is what they called, Quentin Anderson called Emerson the imperial self. That he's constantly expanding and sort of identifying and assuming what we assume and so on. But I think actually that really doesn't take in his entire oeuvre accurately. And, for example, I have a passage. I would love to read this one.
Please.
This is from I Ebbed with the Ocean of Life. It's on the second page. It's section 2. And this is Whitman. It was after the publication of the reviews for Leaves of Grass, and he's. It's a moment where he's sort of trying to renounce everything that he's written. It's a very, very powerful passage, and it's. I'll just read it. You can
please.
As I wend to the shores I know not, as I list to the dirge, the voices of men and women wrecked. As I inhale the impalpable breezes that set in upon me, as the ocean so mysterious rolls toward me closer and closer, I too but signify at the utmost a little washed-up drift, a few sands and dead leaves to gather and merge myself as part of the sands and drift. Oh, baffled, balked, bent to the very earth, oppressed with myself that I have dared to open my mouth, aware now that amid all that blab whose echoes recoil upon me, I have not once had the least idea who or what I am, but that before all my arrogant poems, the real me stands yet untouched, untold, altogether unreached, withdrawn far, mocking me with mock congratulatory signs and bows, with peals of distant, ironical laughter at every word I have written, pointing in silence to these songs and then to the sand beneath. I perceive I have not really understood anything, not a single object, and that no man ever can. Nature here, in sight of the sea, taking advantage of me to dart upon me and sting me because I have dared to open my mouth to sing at all. Yeah.
How do people take those lines? Is there anybody who, well, I say as I do, wants to resist them?
It reminded me of his poem, O Me, O Life, because he was questioning whether what he was doing made any sense or was really worth anything. And to me, it's comforting that he always comes back to this sense of security. So I think even in the passage that you just read, although there is a sense of doubt, the sureness of his words contradict what they say in a way. And it's comforting that someone so positive can also have moments where they falter.
That's beautifully put.
I'll just add on to you. I mean, for me, I get kind of frustrated sometimes about the, like, idea of Whitman as, like, this positive, arrogant guy that, like, just likes to hear himself talk a lot, because to me, I'm always like, did you only read Leaves of Grass? Like, there's, like, I always think of, what's it called? Drum Taps.
Oh, yeah.
The section.
Yeah.
I always point to that because that section of the book is really depressing, mm-hmm. and really honestly painful, and not the same, like, sprawling, arrogant Whitman that everyone seems to sort of take as an oversimplification.
Yeah.
But I agree with Meg that, like, I definitely find comfort when he allows himself to be unedited, in the sense, sometimes I get the feeling he comes back in and, like, makes his negative thoughts positive.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for me, the problem is always our knowing the rhetoric of running yourself down. That is, Montaigne can't write essays without telling you, don't bother to read them, they're just for my family, you surely must have better things to do than read my essays, and so on. And everybody does it. It's a very, very important thing to do, and in some way or other, great writers are able to protect it against the danger of it, which is that it's very, very cadging. You say, my arrogant poems, and then we're kind of supposed to say, oh, come on, Walt, they're not really arrogant, and Walt say, oh, shucks, that's very nice of you, and your toes will point in towards one another. There's a whole manoeuvre of running yourself down. You know, the number of lectures I've heard at BU where the person starts by saying, I can't think why I was invited to give this lecture, it's an extraordinary honour. It is true that I have been governor of the Bank of England, the British Bank of all these things. So that whole stylized gimmick is very, very precarious. Dr. Johnson says all censure of a man's self is oblique praise. It shows how much he can spare. Now, there is something in that. It can't always be true, but it is always true that the person doing this has got, we and he or she have to be on the qui vive to say, what on this occasion saves it from this little ploy? Do you know what I mean? This little ploy of running yourself down, saying all the time that you're humbled. Is that right? This country is full of people who are repeatedly humbled. If they succeed, they're humbled. If they fail, they're humbled. They don't seem to be behaving humbly at all. But it's a way of speaking. Now, I happened in class the other day to be talking about the word arrogant, because I was interested in whether my students knew exactly what it means. It means, of course, arrogating to yourself something that you do not have the power or the right to wield. So it's very different from being very proud or being vain or being very conceited. It has to do with speaking on this occasion as though you were the president of BU when you're not. Mm. You're only the provost, or whatever it might be. Do you see what I mean? That is some curious way in which you arrogate something. It's a very, very important concept. I think Whitman is using it very precisely. Do you know what I mean? But it still remains a question. What are the little antiseptic things which he manages to bring in here?
What are they? The word blab. It's so brilliant.
Yeah.
It's a slang word, he uses it once earlier he talks about the blab of the pave, meaning street talk, and I think that we see there the kind of the energy of the poetry.
Yeah.
I mean, of the language that he's having a good time with us.
Yeah.
So,
Yeah, well, blab can do a terrific lot of prophylactic work. Whether it can do there's something happened. I perceive I've not really understood anything. Well, you do seem to be asked, presumably you've understood that, right? You've understood that you haven't really understood anything. So that I perceive I've not really understood anything, not a single, and that no man ever can. Ha, ha, ha. German, if right, no man ever can, I'm the equal of Socrates, I'm the equal of Aristotle. So the curious, it isn't an empty game, but there is a game. There's a gamesmanship to it, isn't there? And it, because I've dared to open my mouth to sing at all. If you're in Stalin's world, or if you're in Nero's world, daring to open your mouth to sing at all is a real thing. Yeah. Whitman, blessedly, was not in that world. Yeah. And what it really is to try daring to open your mouth in half of the regimes of the world at the moment.
So this is not going to be oblique praise, but I am being honest. I've only read two lines of Whitman before coming to this lecture, one of which I would always look like a fool on this escalator in D.C., which has a giant line of his in stone, and I try to read it while I'm going up the escalator. Does not work well because you look like this. I don't know how you're going to get that on radio. And the second one was I bought Walt Whitman beer once, which tastes like Dayquil, and it was... I don't recommend it. Anyway, I read those two lines. I forget both of them. But what I'm noticing with the poems we've read today, especially the one where he says, I guess, a lot, is that they're very personal. I feel that I may have had these thoughts or that I've had this indecision. And he has this indecision that feels authentic almost, where it's like, where it seems he doesn't want to make the broad statement that life is this or... grass is this, but that it's a few things. It's guesses, and kind of everything seems to be guesswork. I guess that's it.
Yeah, Whitman thought a lot about putting what he called his personality on paper, and what he meant was that he wouldn't be self-censoring in any way. That he wanted his kind of his personality to be there, and the fact that he wrote so many, constantly reworking the collection up through his deathbed edition suggests that his the individuality, what's most personal about the poetry was tremendously important to him in the context of a kind of print culture. He thought publishing was very important. He also thought that bringing this sort of free personality to bear on that, to project that was very important. So I think you're right.
Well, I think part of the print culture thing for me, but it's true I'm coming at in a way sort of technically, has to do with the things that the eye can see but the voice can't utter. You cannot say a round bracket. You can say something parenthetically, but you can't say, the voice cannot deliver that this is a round bracket as against a square bracket, as against a dash, as against a comma. So there are really important effects which have to do here, and you read them, I think, very beautifully, very faithfully to them, but it's an impossible task. Mm-hmm. They are within what Erasmus calls lunulae. Little moons, these things are little moons, and an immense number of the great poets have liked doing things that have to do with the moons, or have to do with bandy legs, or have to do with something that's got this lovely curving shape. And if you tuck them up within that, they become at once an aside, something that's not the main thing you're saying, and a crux. The most important thing I'm going to say, I'm going to tuck up safely so that you don't violate it. So that I'm not too naked with it. It's really important. It's deep, deep. Now, he does that, but it's very strange because he is above all a poet of the speaking voice. You think that it's very, very important to hear them. Yeah. And you can hear them in the theatre of your head, but when you read them, you can't actually render the punctuation. It's not reproducible. So there's a very strange tension. You were talking about contradictions. There are very strange contradictions between how it's punctuated and then the instructions as to how you should say it, because there isn't any voicing that can do right by that, right? Any more than in there is a page that can do right by a homophone. On stage or in a song, you can have not bear the knife myself, meaning carry it, B-A-R, and unsheath it, B-A-R-E. So Macbeth should not murder Duncan, not bear the knife myself. And simultaneously, it's both carried and taken out in a split second and so on. Now, the page can't do that. So the page is always having to say, the mouth is always having to say to the ear, I need you to. There are things that you can do that I simply cannot do, whatever my genius. Now, they are very, very extraordinarily beautiful effects, and they mattered a lot when you're reading of them. Can I read Come Up from the Fields, Father?
Let me read that,
because, again, it has to do with... I'd want to concede everything about... He was a great and wonderful person, and he was right to think so. But it is dangerous to go around thinking all the time that you're a great and wonderful person. And no man is saying, well, I'm just like everybody else. But you're just like everybody else. I don't manage to be like everybody else, and so on. So, but here he imagines other people in tragedy. Come up from the fields, Father. Here's a letter from our Pete. And come to the front door, Mother. Here's a letter from thy dear son. Lo, 'tis autumn. Lower the trees, deeper green, yellower and redder. Cool and sweet in Ohio's villages, with leaves fluttering in the moderate wind. Where apples ripe in the orchard hang, and grapes on the trellis vines. Smell you the smell of the grapes on the vines? Smell you the buckwheat where the bees were lately buzzing? Above all, lo, the sky so calm, so transparent after the rain, and with wondrous clouds. Below, too, all calm, all vital and beautiful. The farm prospers well. Down in the fields, all prospers well. But now from the fields, come, Father, come at the daughter's call, and come to the entry, Mother, to the front door. Come right away. Fast as she can, she hurries, something ominous. Her steps trembling. She does not tarry to smooth her hair nor adjust her cap. Open the envelope quickly. Oh, this is not our son's writing. Yet his name is signed. Oh, a strange hand writes for our dear son. Oh, stricken mother's soul all swims before her eyes, flashes with black. She catches the main words only. Sentences broken. Gunshot wound in the breast. Cavalry skirmish. Taken to hospital. At present, low, but will soon be better. Ah, now the single figure to me amid all teeming and wealthy Ohio with all its cities and farms. Sickly, white in the face and dull in the head, very faint, by the jamb of a door leans. Grieve not so, dear mother, the just-grown daughter speaks through her sobs. The little sisters huddle around, speechless and dismayed. See, dearest mother, the letter says Pete will soon be better. Alas, poor boy. He'll never be better, nor maybe needs to be better, that brave and simple soul. While they stand at the door, at home at the door, he is dead already. The only son is dead. But the mother needs to be better. She, with thin form, presently dressed in black, by day her meals untouched, then at night fitfully sleeping, often waking, in the midnight waking, weeping, longing with one deep longing. Oh, that she might withdraw unnoticed, silent, from life, escape, and withdraw to follow, to seek, to be with her dear dead son. Now, again, it doesn't put the others, as it were, in their place in any bad way, but it releases things in him, because it releases him from him. You know, there's just much, much less of him, except right. As the mediator of this extraordinary thing. There's a Dylan song, some of you will know it, which takes the lines about he's already dead. Dylan sings them very, very beautifully, very, very touching in that song, across the Green Mountain. He just goes in on that. It's too long a song for us to play now. But now I think the unutterability of italics, you can't say italics, but their power is terrific. Do you mean they're ontologically different from anything else, yeah, and so on. This is a poem. Is it a poem for you, greatly?
It's wonderful, and it's very. I mean, what's so interesting in the context of the other Civil War poems? It's very, very distinctive, I think, precisely because the voice is not the Whitman voice. I mean, when you come up from the fields, father, here's a letter from our Pete. Yeah. You know, he's capturing a kind of a voice that's not the one that we hear throughout Leaves of Grass. And I think, and also the fact that he's sort of exploring the text of the letter as opposed to his own, so much of his Civil War writing is very, very explicit in sort of the details of the war. And here we have the impact of the letter, which is, you know, so much is concealed, and in the very concealment of the young kid's suffering is where we see the impact of the poem. I think it's very powerful, and I'm so impressed that Dylan chose this poem, because it has that kind of folk ballad feel to it, which Whitman did not explore. I mean, there were other poets, his contemporaries, Whittier and people like that, who are looking at the ballad tradition, but this captures it. It's really fascinating.
It's been a wonderful treat. Thank you very much,
thank
everyone.
You.
Thanks very much, Professor Ricks, Professor Patterson.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a discussion titled Walt Whitman, the Year of His Birth, 1819, featuring William M. and Sarah B. Warren, Professor of the Humanities, Christopher Ricks. Tonight's moderator was Boston University Professor of English, Anita Patterson. We began with a greeting by Sean Knoll, Associate Director of the Boston University Howard Gottlieb Archival Research Center, which sponsored tonight's event. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth, with help from Lee Shuna. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us.